Welcome to the first episode of Acro Capital's in-house podcast, where we have guests in the startup scene from all over Africa. My name is Christopher Dritton, and I'm an angel investor and short seller, and I've recently come on board at Acro as a program director here in Cape Town. My guest is Jason Basil, who is an Acro co-founder. Acro, amongst other things, is his brainchild, so I'll let him explain his background and what Acro is all about.
Sure. So I was born in South Africa, but I spent some, you might hear some American in the accent, I spent some time in the US, mostly in South Florida, Miami. So I studied finance at UCT, and after I studied finance, I was always into entrepreneurship, just starting startups and, I don't know, kind of creating things. And I started an education technology company called EduOne straight out of university, or I suppose more at university than after it. I was sort of known for, I think I maybe attended sort of 5 lectures a year.
But you passed, eh?
I did. I passed I worked just hard enough. I got like 51 or 52 for every course.
That was me at music college,
I'm sure.
Yeah, I was trading the markets and I was supposed to be practicing piano, you know?
Yeah.
It's definitely the opposite for most people.
For sure, yeah. Yeah, well, I was same as you. So mostly started businesses. And by the time I left university, EduOne had sort of gotten to a point where it seemed worthy of, you know, my full-time engagement and having a whack, as it were. So I kind of got stuck into EduOne, and I've been doing that for the last 5.5 years. And I'm on my way out of EduOne at the moment. We've sort of achieved some modicum of success, I would say.
Well, you bit off a lot, hey? I mean, like, edutech is not so easy, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, I guess it depends on where you are and really where you are as far as edtech is concerned, because I was kind of stuck into edtech at a time where South Africa...
It wasn't cool.
It wasn't cool at the beginning, but I got to tell you, over the last 3 years...
In the US, it's picking up now, especially with social distancing.
In a big way.
Yeah, it's very much...
Yeah, there's been some really great tech edtech companies coming out of South Africa as well. I guess the go-to is Get Smarter, sold to a US company fairly recently for quite a big sum. So that sort of put edtech on the map, and there was a slew of edtech companies, startups that sort of cropped up after that exit. So yeah.
Yeah. So what are you working on now?
Yeah. I'm on my way out of EduOne, as I said. At EduOne, we did some cool things with in the career guidance space. That's sort of our claim to fame. We built a website called EduConnect that helps over 2.7 million users every year, figure out what to study or where to study or how to finance their studies. And that experience was, or the experience of building EduConnect was really rewarding in one sense. But in another, I always felt that I was missing something. So I consider myself a natural teacher. I really enjoy sitting down with someone and practically teaching them things that I know to be true that they may not know yet. And EdTech was in some ways a way for me to sort of expound on that strength, or just that, you know, that interest. And in particular, the career guidance component of what I did at EduOne was that. But it wasn't direct enough. I always felt that was missing. There wasn't sort of, you know, there was a glass wall in between me and our users. You know, they were interacting with a website that was very independent of sort of face-to-face, sitting over a cup of coffee and, you know, helping this person figure out where they're going to go in life. So, you know, as I transition out of EduConnect, I'm shifting into something new, which I guess I'll get into some detail, but maybe perhaps not too much. I'm trying to kind of keep this close to my chest. But really, what I want to do is be much more directly involved in teaching and consulting and helping people figure out their way. Mm-hmm. And we have a bit of an idea, I guess you could say, to help the broader population with their endeavors in a very direct way.
Cool. So let's talk about Acro. What are the origins of Acro? What's Acro's origin story?
Acro's got kind of two origin stories. The original one is kind of less glamorous. It was really just an opportunistic thing when I was at university, I had 8 entrepreneurially minded friends, and we always got along really well together. We'd have conversations about just the future of work and the future of all these different industries, and we just had these really exciting conversations. And then at some point along the line, we thought we'd hold a public event where the 9 of us and anyone else who wanted to attend would come and just discuss interesting topics. And we happened to get on radio and acquire some sponsors. And we thought, oh, well, this is actually cool. Maybe we should make a business out of this, be able to earn a little bit of money while we're studying as well. And that was the sort of original founding story. We held events together. There was, the 9 of us, and from time to time would invite other people and get sponsors and whatnot. So really unglamorous, just an opportunity for, interesting, like-minded people to get together and discuss interesting things. But as a lot of things do, when you have 9 alpha male, youngsters in a room together, things can blow up. So, there's a little bit of infighting and just, disagreements as to what we should do with the business. And so we disbanded it quite shortly after that, maybe a year after we originally formed it. And then a couple of years ago, through my experience building EduOne, I had a lot of exposure to other founders, other young founders doing, similar stuff to me. And everyone had the same problems, just these sort of recurring questions that kept coming up. There was 2 in particular, and then, as I sort of delved deeper into it, there was a lot more. And the 2 questions were, on one hand, everyone was asking, where the heck do I acquire financing? Just to the extent that I can pay food, I can pay for my food and rent, for 6 months to give this business a shot. And there was just nowhere that they could turn for this. And the second thing was sort of the technical, difficulties or knowledge that was required to execute deals. So, when someone did have an investor, they had no clue what their options were. The standard is, you give me money, I give you shares, but at what valuation, and what is the difference between post and pre-money valuation,
and safes and convertible notes?
Yeah, convertible notes. What are my options other than just straight up giving away shares for cash? And people had lots of these types of questions, and so I thought, let me sort of reignite the Acro spark, and with scope to help. To be an aid to entrepreneurs starting out who had all these same questions, and so that's where we started, sort of producing content, these accelerator programs, now the digital platform, the Acro app, and the other things that we're doing, all with scope to be an aid to entrepreneurs. So that's really where it all started.
So, yeah, what is Acro's mission, really? I've heard you talk about the funding gap between pre-revenue and VC money in South Africa, particularly.
Yeah, so this is a South African problem. It's an African problem. And I would go so far as to say it's a worldwide problem with a very limited number of exclusions. And those places where this problem is excluded are the sort of world hubs for entrepreneurial hubs like Silicon Valley and London, etc. And the problem is that there are young people, typically young people, sometimes working, sometimes studying. I guess it depends, but they just need 6 months or a year of food and rent to give their thing a shot. They don't need funding, as it were. They just need food and rent. Okay, this is completely not in the domain of venture capitalists or oftentimes angel investors even, because investors typically need sort of some kind of evidence that there is a thing that that you've built something, or that there's some modicum
traction,
and so that's definitely not the domain of venture capitalists and private equity firms, largely it's not even the domain of angel investors. So we want to the goal of Acro is to bridge that gap. It's to find people who are worthy of acquiring a shot at goal and giving them a shot at goal, just giving them 6 months or a year to sort of prove that they can build something or gain some amount of traction that is significant enough to warrant, you know, your mainstream investors, your angel investors, your venture capitalists to come in and fund the thing from the get-go.
So the Silicon Valley, for instance, there would be much higher resolution in the fundraising spectrum. Like you can get funding for that sort of thing, like from people if you know anyone, you know.
There's a lot more openness. There's a lot more investors are a lot more sophisticated. We were speaking just now about an angel investor based in the U.S. that, you know, has made 150 investments or something along those lines.
Yeah.
You would be hard-pressed to find someone... of, you know, who's made an equivalent number or anywhere near that number of investments in South Africa or really anywhere in Africa. There's just so few of them. And that's what is needed. We need 150 people at a time taking a shot on goal. And the great thing about it is that they don't need millions and millions of rands or dollars or whatever. They need just rent and food. Because we just don't have enough of those. We're never going to get, you know, out of the rat race, or, you know, the poverty cycle will just continue unless we can enable enough people to just get out of that for long enough to prove that they are worthy of taking on investment and trying to grow something.
So that's a good layout of the problem. What has Accra done really to tackle that problem?
Yeah, so Accra has obviously evolved since the sort of the origin stories that I was just spitting out. So we've taken a sort of multi-layered approach to sort of tackling this problem as directly as possible. The first is we're running programs, accelerator and incubator programs, and we've taken the approach of working with corporates and governments who typically fund these programs, largely because, especially in an African context, we need to facilitate B2B relationships or sort of commercial B2B relationships for the startups that we're working with. So working with these partners, with government and with corporate partners, enables not only the funding of these programs, but also for the startups that come through them to acquire their first sort of set of corporate or government clients after the fact. So we're running accelerator programs that are, we call them super early stage. So this is like 99% focused on the people and the idea. They're definitely, you know, there's a sort of popular maxim that the idea doesn't matter. It definitely does matter, but it's less important to have a fully fledged idea than it is to have a person who is dedicated to the nth degree. We've taken the approach of starting these super early stage accelerator/incubator programs that focus on the individual and the idea, and we bring them in through a program where we help them to chiefly develop their product or service to get it to sort of a minimum viable product. It's thrown around a little bit too much, but get it into a state at which it is presentable to an investor audience. So that's sort of the first tier. The second tier is our angel syndicates. So we work with a number of angel investors and venture capitalists from around South Africa and soon to be the rest of Africa to provide deal flow to them and to generally improve exposure for the startups that come through our programs to investors. Because unlike many of the startup hubs across much of the first world, across Africa, startups just don't know investors. They don't have access to investors. They don't really have exposure to even the difference between angel investors and the more formal venture capital economy. So we're building a lot of relationships through an angel syndicate and a number of other things that we do with investors just to kind of bridge that gap and make sure that there's exposure both ways.
And as far as the actual program goes, we're putting that online. We're currently in the process of uploading all our lessons, all the actual program content online. But also, there's a thing in the works called the Accra app. And could you tell us about that a bit?
Yeah, I was wondering when you were going to come to that. So that's really the third leg in this whole thing. And so the Accra app is a platform, a digital platform that facilitates engagements between, call them experts or advisors, and the entrepreneur themselves. So really what we were trying to do is we were looking at the accelerator program and we were saying, okay, so the vast majority of the value of the program, of our program, as well as pretty much any program, is the transfer of perspective from people who know stuff to people who don't.
People who've done it.
So in the case of, professional expertise like lawyers, explaining to an entrepreneur what a convertible note is and sort of what the key clauses are and whatnot, that sort of transfer of perspective and knowledge is critical, as well as sort of more generic perspective from someone who's built a company, just speaking to and relating to people who are just embarking on that journey now.
But crucially now, the startup can take their individual problem to that person and get perspective on it straight away, rather than having to learn all the stuff and then...
Yeah, I think really, if you want to know how to do anything, if you want to know how to build a rocket, you can learn everything you need to know about rocket science on Google. Like, the information is indexed and available, but perspective is not. If I wanted to go and build a rocket, I wouldn't just Google. I would want to go and speak to rocket scientists. And if you actually just examine that a little bit deeper, you're like, why the heck would you want to go and speak to people if all the information is freely available online? And the reason is because you need more than information. You need an amalgamation of information, emotional understanding and resonance, direction in terms of, don't worry so much about these things. This is more important.
For you, there are unknown unknowns, but for them, they know how to,
It's a case of, the best word for it is really perspective, facilitating the transfer of perspective. So this third, the Acro app is a platform that enables experts and advisors that are within the Acro network, perhaps, participating as mentors or advisors in one of the programs, to list their sort of professional profiles and avail themselves to entrepreneurs. And the entrepreneurs coming through the programs can then reach out to them through the platform and book a cup of coffee to go and discuss their pitch deck or generally get advice or perspective on whatever it is that they're looking for.
And they can book a physical meeting with the person, or they can have, a Zoom call or whatever.
Yeah, so I'm curious actually to see where, in the spirit of the lean startup and sort of taking your cues from the market, I'm curious to see what those, what formats of engagement tend to be more popular. Initially, we are starting with, face-to-face engagements and video conferences, because we feel that that's sort of an ideal format for the transfer of perspective, meeting up with an expert and having a cup of coffee at a cafe or having a video call seems to be an appropriate format, but I don't know, we'll have to see where that goes.
Okay, cool. So at Acro, what do we look for when we're shortlisting during the startup selection process?
So during the startup selection process, or our process is really focused on the individuals. The first thing that comes to mind here is commitment, which is something that people really don't grasp well enough, I don't think, and is something that is rare to find in an entrepreneur. And what that really is just, if you find someone who has an idea and is so committed, they need to be utterly committed to whatever it is, to this idea, to making this thing a reality.
It's not startup tourism.
That's an interesting phrase. I've never heard that before. But yes, there are so many entrepreneurs, inverted commas, that out there that, are all excited about this idea and they've pumped with energy and they're smart and all the rest of it. But when it really comes down to it, they're not prepared to commit to quit their job. They're not prepared to live in, a one-bedroom apartment for 3 years or 5 years or however long it takes. They want their weekends. I've got nothing against the weekends. I love weekends too. But, that's really one of the key things that we're looking for. You don't get to be an entrepreneur and have the luxury of just deciding that you don't want to work today, or that you really have to be prepared to go the whole way. Hopefully you don't have to, but you need to be prepared to. So we look for that in the entrepreneurs when we're shortlisting them for the programs. Something else we look for is a viable idea. again, perhaps something that sounds obvious, but also not so obvious. There are a lot of ideas that are kind of on the right track. There may be like, and you know, we're not necessarily the experts, but at figuring out what will and won't work, but we can certainly apply some common sense to say, are they onto something that there is a way to make this thing work? There is a way. We may not know what it is, but there will be a way. Versus there are a lot of ideas that come to us that there's just plainly no way to make this thing work. Like, and it's can be quite obvious if you start thinking about it deeply. If you start looking at the fundamentals of the business or of the industry that they're playing in. You know, for example, something that there are a number of businesses that require the only sort of value addition that these entrepreneurs or these startups could bring to the market is a massive cost reduction in whatever it is that they're doing. And if you just look at like the fundamental cost of delivering that service or that good, you know, the value of the raw materials or the capital required to just tool a factory to produce this thing, you know, the shot at actually reducing the cost of that thing just can't happen fundamentally, like physically. And there's lots of things like that that come through us that there's just no way to make it happen. There's no way to create that 10x value improvement or value addition that needs to happen to make the whole business viable.
Or so unlikely, you know, as well, you know.
Yeah. Well, unlikely is good. I mean, like, if someone's taking a moonshot. If someone's taking a moonshot, like...
A musk shot.
Good for them.
So how much technical expertise do you need as a tech founder or CEO, actually? Because you get other co-founders that have other skills, yeah. You know.
I'm a non-technical co-founder, by and large. And actually, that's maybe one of the important points is that I'm a non-technical co-founder, by and large. So yes, I don't code. I don't necessarily have the technical expertise to build the product, but I can speak the language. I can sit in a room with a software developer and have a conversation that, you know, I don't perhaps embarrass myself in. I'm sure I do from time to time, but not too often.
But it's okay, you know.
That's fine. But it is important to have at least a high level understanding of the technical capabilities that are required to build your product or service. So I would say that you definitely need to have some technical expertise in your team. There needs to be someone who in your team that is capable of building the thing. We have a lot of founders come through or sort of apply to programs or engage with us. There's a lot of people who will say, I'm starting a mobile app. I'm a business person. I have no technical experience whatsoever, and I'm going to outsource the development of my app to a dev house. That's my plan to get the product up and going. That is not a viable solution. You need to have someone, a co-founder, someone senior in your team that is capable of actually building the thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not absolutely necessary for everybody in the team to be capable of doing so. But then again, I would argue for the people that are non-technical or don't have the capacity to build the thing, you need to develop at least a high-level understanding. You need to know enough to have a conversation and be able to problem-solve right alongside your technical co-founders.
Yeah. I've heard you talk about how Silicon Valley is obsessed with intelligence, but there's a minimum level of intelligence you need, and then after that, the material gains are minimal, and you should rather be a doer.
Yeah, I think that's actually, I don't know, I know that Warren Buffett has said that fairly often. I think he says, if you've got sort of an IQ north of 115 or 120, like, you know, just sell the rest of the IQ points because you don't need them. That's definitely true. I think that kind of intelligence is lauded more than it should be, possibly because we look at some of the most successful entrepreneurs
like Musk. I mean,
Musk, Bezos,
yeah, they're both
Zuckerberg.
Geniuses. I mean, three of them apparently are geniuses.
Yeah, I have no doubt. I mean, you listen to those guys they're on some other level. But it's not building a $1 billion company or rather a $1 trillion company these days is not necessarily, you know, you don't have to do that. $1 billion company.
And be happier.
Definitely be happier, I'm sure. Yeah, so I don't think that, you know, despite the fact that there are, you know, some crazy smart quadrillionaires out there, you don't need to be an absolute genius. Having a bias for action is definitely preferred. Yeah, I think anyone listening to this podcast is probably on the north end of the IQ scale. So we're probably not...
To have gotten this far, you know, to be cerebral enough to get this far because, you know...
Yeah, to sort of have the wherewithal to actually engage with this type of content in the first place sort of suggests that you're on the north end of that scale. So, you know, this the intelligence discussion probably doesn't apply to anyone listening to this podcast. there certainly is a baseline. Like, I don't know what that number is, but I would... There definitely are people that you would never want to work with because they just don't make the cut as far as intelligence is concerned. But yeah, beyond sort of a reasonable degree of intelligence, it's all about just getting the thing done. If you can sit down and execute for hours and hours and hours on end, if you can do the boring grind day in and day out for years, that is what will set you apart.
Definitely, yeah. Because that compounds, you know.
Doesn't that suck?
I know.
I wish that wasn't the case.
I feel like I'm too much of a thinker, you know. I'll plan out things and then nothing gets done, you know, because I've planned out this long probability tree or whatever, but that doesn't help, you know, just do it.
You know, that's actually another thing, you know, and in the vast majority of people that make it are not, that make their businesses, that get their businesses to some degree of success are not 150 plus, you know, don't have 150 plus IQ points. And I think that's what you just touched on, exactly the reason for that, which is that... you know, if you're too cerebral, you spend too much time thinking and strategizing and analyzing and sort of figuring, making all the decisions before you've actually executed anything.
Yeah.
And the nature of entrepreneurship is that you don't know everything. It doesn't matter if you've got 150 IQ points.
Squeeze out the inefficiencies afterwards, you know what I mean? But just pull through for now, you know, I guess. So for me, one of the biggest red flags when it comes to backing a founder is... a market salary. They want a market salary. If they want a market, if they're not prepared to take under a market salary, they will give up. And also another thing is that they won't do certain jobs, you know, within the startup. What are your red flags, would you say?
I think the two things that you just mentioned speak directly to commitment. I think that if you have an idea and you want to make this thing work, do you want to make it work at all costs or at no cost? And you just describe like someone who's not prepared to pay anything.
Exactly. But people can, they can pretend like they have commitment for a while. But if they do these few things, then it's a red flag that shows you that they don't have. Another thing is that they won't start working until they're funded.
Yeah. Look, I mean, there are some practicalities to this. There are people that have got families and that want to start a company, but they don't have the luxury of taking big risks, and that is just a fact of life that they do actually have those commitments, and I sympathize with, or at least I empathize with people who are in that position, and for that reason I would encourage people to take risks earlier on before you've got kids in a family. That's a massive advantage that no one really
thinks about. Yeah,
you don't think about it when you're 20 something, but. Like,
take your output curve and then just, you know, minus 2 points from it, you know, at all levels if you have kids, you know.
Exactly.
But I mean, yeah, kids, I'm not saying kids aren't, you know, a source of meaning in your life, you know, could be, I don't know, but...
Yeah, for sure. But at the end of the day, like, you know, starting startups is really difficult.
It's
really, you have to give yourself every advantage that you can get, and one of the few that is, you know, that is freely at your disposal is this commitment thing. You know, you talk about a market-related salary. Again, I've got no problem with taking a market-related salary, but that can't be the condition on which you will do the thing.
Yeah,
you need to be able to do it anyways. And if you can afford a market salary, great. If you can afford 2x, if you can afford to pay yourself really well, like, great, good for you. I've got nothing against it, but. That can't be a condition on which you commit.
In the eyes of an investor, it will reduce your probability of success, you know. So progress in which industry is most needed for humanity currently, would you say?
That's quite a difficult question to answer.
I mean, I would say pollution tech, you know, dealing with pollution, someone inventing some biodegradable housing for food rather than plastic, you know, that's what I would love to see.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a number of broad fields or industries like what you've just described that are important for sort of just the general advancements of the human species and just for life to be better. But I don't know if I could sort of rank order them in terms of what's more and less important. And I would also argue that for people starting companies or starting startups, that they don't necessarily have to participate in, you know, what they would call the most important, the most important industry for the advancement of the human civilization. Like these are very...
Yeah, Musk thought about these things after he'd made his money a bit, you know what I mean? So he already had like 200 million in 1990-something, and he thought about these things afterwards.
Yeah, I think these are things that also just become emboldened over time. It's not... But, you know, if you're participating in an industry that you're passionate about and that you think is generally important for, any subset of people, it doesn't have to be humanity, like the largest scale possible. It can be, you know, your community or the, you know, some significant subset of humanity. If you're doing something that is adding value to that subset of humanity, then I think that's absolutely
definitely good enough. Doing. Yeah. So you've always been a proponent of Elon, and you know,
this is not a secret.
No, it's not a secret. No. So why is Elon so great?
Elon Musk is the biggest thinker, and in fact, do you know what? More than anything else, he's the biggest thinker in the world of entrepreneurship. He's the biggest thinker on the planet. He's like mind-bogglingly smart. But the thing that really sets Elon apart, that there are other incredibly smart people, there are other people who think incredibly big, but the thing that just consistently blows my mind,
puts himself on the line.
It's not even that. There are other people who put themselves on the line. The thing that blows my mind absolutely about Elon Musk is the extent to which he can consistently do the grind. He can sit and do meeting after meeting. He can write paper after paper. He just does, you know, he can do the calculation after calculation, whatever the actual work is, the execution work that he needs to do that day. He's been doing that for his whole life. I mean, since he started the first company, Zip2, he's just grafted like nobody I've ever known. And there's so many, I mean, after every company that he started, started, sold, and then started again, there's like no time in between each thing. I mean, for example, after PayPal was sold to eBay, he took, I think, a week vacation or something, and then got stuck straight back into it. Yeah. And this is not...
Mission-orientated.
Just absolutely mission-orientated, driven beyond measure. But yeah, just the ability to execute day in and day out for 20 years plus is just absolutely mind-blowing to me. Yeah, that's really the thing I think that sets Elon Musk apart, in addition to the crazy big thinking and the crazy intelligence as well.
Yeah. People argue that Bezos is better all around, you know?
This is not... Okay, the way that I'm assessing this is not in a case of who's better in terms of, building a company or something.
No,
this
of course is just not, like, but you would say...
Wow factor.
No, of course, yeah.
Musk beats anybody ever, I think, on wow factor. There are no names that you can put in the same category. No names. You go back 2,000 years, you cannot put any name in the same category.
That's what I was going to say, like, you know, Thomas Edison, you know, like, whatever, you know, people will be writing books about this guy, you know.
As far as wow factor is concerned, as far as just slap you in the face, wake you up, like, okay, Musk wins. Musk is in his own category. If you talk about company building, or if you talk about, you know, who's the best at X, you know, X thing, sure, okay, we can probably put Musk in categories with other people like Bezos and you know, historical figures like Thomas Edison, Benjamin Franklin, but Yeah, Musk just blows our minds.
He's advanced us the most, you know. It's electric cars and it's space travel. I mean, without him, we'd be back, you know, 20 years, 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, the breadth of the things that Musk has tackled, from banking.
Oh, yes, like
finance.
Ah, yeah.
The whole world of finance, the biggest industry in the world by a long shot, online. I mean, before, we don't appreciate this, before X.com, which became PayPal, when it merged with, when X.com merged with Confinity, before that, there was no such thing as digital banking.
Yeah.
That was the origin of everything that you do today when you make EFTs. And I mean, the entire world of finance and banking came online because of that company. That was due in part to Musk's brilliance. You know, after that, there was, you know, you talk about electric cars, solar energy production, you know, space travel, making space travel affordable and just generally accessible. I mean, this is the standard deviation of, like, the knowledge. There is no intersection of knowledge for any of these things.
Well, that's the thing. When I listen to his story, it kind of, first of all, it makes me, well, initially it makes me depressed because, I mean, you know, how are you ever going to do anything? Whatever I do will pale into insignificance compared to him, what he's done. But then also it says, like, also, after that, I feel, well, he's also human, you know? When I watch a video of him, I can see him think, you know, why can't I achieve more than I have been, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's also that commitment thing. You know, I mean, obviously he's, you know, 150 IQ, but it's the grind that he, so he can actually execute. And that's the thing, you know?
Yeah.
It's like having a, it's like, why does a modern Ferrari will beat an old, those old Jaguar or McLaren F1? It's because the McLaren F1 will spin its wheels. It can't put the power down. It has more power than a modern Ferrari, but it can't put that power down on the road. The wheels just spin. And Musk can put his power on the road by execution, you know.
In there have been a number of psychological studies done that suggest, well, not suggest, like they say unequivocally that, or really prove unequivocally, that outside of a baseline intelligence measured in IQ and your starting point, in other words, your sort of what sort of income level you're starting at, you know, whether you're starting rich, whether you're sort of brought up rich or poor, outside of those two factors, which are sort of obvious for predicting life success, the factor which has the most influence is conscientiousness. And that's exactly what I was speaking about earlier. I think Musk has sort of presented a degree of conscientiousness which just far supersedes you know, the abilities of 99.9% of the world. You know, and that coupled with intelligence and big thinking propels them to another level. But I know it, I can definitely relate to what you were saying just now about sort of feeling a bit, you know, introspecting a little bit and thinking, sheesh, like anything I do will pale in comparison. I don't really have any good comments on that other than to say that
yes,
maybe just yes, default back to you know, how do I make myself happy?
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, you know, Musk probably isn't the happiest person in the world.
Yeah, I have no doubt that that's the case.
But yeah, he's kind of doing it for everyone else as well, kind of, you know. Although, I mean, he likes to gloat.
Pass.
Yeah. Okay, so now we're going to move on to a medium fire round of 10 questions. Which current developments give you hope for the future of humankind?
Space travel. Man, that's exciting. Oh my goodness, I can't wait to go to space.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, totally.
And possibly agri-tech. There's a lot of exciting things happening in agri-tech.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is about agri-tech, but it really does excite me.
Like the no-meat movement, you know, beyond meat. Yeah.
The no-meat movement, like, oh, I love growing that. Meat, like actual meat, without using animals.
I know, that's exciting. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, the whole food industry, just the way that it's moving is absolutely mind-blowing.
It will reduce the cumulative suffering in the world. Name something you would advise super early stage founders to cultivate super early.
An ability to constantly turn around and say, you know, the cliched words, so what, now what? The ability to just keep putting your nose to the grindstone and doing what needs to be done. Whenever something bad happens, instead of reacting, you know, by flipping out and then slowly coming back down to reality and getting back to it, immediately turning around and saying, okay, something bad happened, so what? Okay, now what? What's next? What's the next thing that I need to do?
Exactly, because if you think about it, in a year's time, you won't think it's that hectic. You'll be like, wow, it actually turned out to be all right, or you know what I mean? Like,
I've never been a big fan of poetry. I always found it strange that you know, poets try to say very simple things in the most complex terms possible, that we have to sit there and decipher it in, you know, 400-page books.
Yeah.
But there's one poem that I'm a massive fan of, and it's called If by Rudyard Kipling. And I encourage all entrepreneurs to read that. In that poem, Rudyard Kipling talks about being able to, when things go south, to sort of bend down and pick up your tools and carry on. Just do the next right thing. Do it again and again and again. And if you can keep doing that indefinitely without ever complaining, you know, without sort of, I don't know, all the sort of emotion that goes with it, if you can put that all into perspective and just keep saying, okay, so what? Now what? What's next? And just go and do that thing. Get into that habit as quickly as possible. And it's a habit. It's a learned thing.
Cool. Total recapitalization or shut your company down and start another?
I'm a hypocrite here because I've done the former, but I would encourage the latter. Even if it's the same thing.
Can be fairer to the investors.
It's partly about fairness to investors, but it's also just chances of success. Like, as soon as momentum is lost, you're wasting your time. As soon as momentum is lost, shut it, kill it, move on.
And then, you know, you can choose to offer your initial investors, you know, a stake, you know, in on the next, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, sure. Do whatever you need to do is, you know, in terms of whatever you feel your moral obligation is, you know, fulfill your moral obligation and no more. Don't overfulfill your obligations. Be very clear of where those lines sit. But as soon as momentum is lost, the amount of effort required to recapitalize the company and get just back to where you started, never mind, you know, where you want to go, is obscene. I've seen that time and time again. So definitely kill it, start again, even if it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. What's the first good business book that comes to mind?
The Lean Startup.
Intelligence or relentlessness?
Relentlessness, hands down.
What's the best piece of advice you've received?
The best piece of advice I've ever received was to be transparent and just tell people what's going on. You know, I've had so many questions about this before, you know, from young entrepreneurs that are kind of starting out, saying, you know, they kind of scoff at the idea that, you know, people would let their companies fail without, you know, and not even, and their investors only find out, like, you know, a week before the company actually fails. And they sort of scoff at this idea that, oh my goodness, I would never do that. But I got to tell you, it is incredibly, like, emotionally taxing, and sometimes strategically difficult, or you know, nonsensical, to go and tell everybody what's going on, investors, employees, whatnot, when things are not going well. But the best piece of advice I ever received was to just be absolutely and utterly transparent. Like, just go and tell everyone what's going on every step of the way, wherever possible. Somehow it reduces your own stress massively, which helps you to execute. Sometimes, you know, good things come out of the woodwork just by being transparent. People want to help. I think communicating when things are not going well even more than when things are going well.
Mm-hmm, yeah. What's your favorite material object you own?
I don't actually have any. Nothing comes to mind.
Yeah, you aren't very material. I mean, I've got loads of, you know, trinkets that I like, but you don't.
I have lots of, like, saved, like, favorites on Etsy and of interesting bits and bobs that I found. But yeah, I guess nothing really comes to mind.
Okay, well, that's a very good answer, you know.
Is it?
Yeah.
Great.
If you weren't involved in startup land, what would you be doing?
I'd be a content producer. it speaks directly to that nature, to that teaching nature of mine.
Take a laptop and hike up the Alp, an Alp, and do it from there.
Absolutely, yeah. Get out in nature. I don't know, produce content for...
Once Starlink is up, then you can do that.
Absolutely. I don't know if that's a good thing. I'm a little nervous about, going out into the woods and no longer being out of reception, out of range of reception. But I'd probably be a content producer, produce content that would be useful for people I care about, like entrepreneurs and adventurers.
Elon or Bezos?
Pass. Too easy.
We've covered these questions are for other people. If you could have any three founders, dead or alive, over for dinner, who would they be?
I don't know about three. Okay, I would definitely say Ben Franklin. You might not call him a founder, but he's a founder.
Oh, yeah, that's very interesting, yeah.
Yeah, Ben Franklin is absolutely incredible. If you've read any of his work, it's the guy writes or wrote so eloquently. Definitely Ben Franklin, Musk for sure. Yeah, so I'd say Musk and Ben Franklin. I'd rather sort of split my time 50-50 between those two rather than diluting it for anyone else.
Okay. Now 10 no think yes or no questions.
Oh boy.
There'll be a million people on Mars before we die.
Yes.
Work-life balance.
No.
The Earth is definitely flat.
Yes.
This statement is not a double negative.
Yes.
It was a bit unfair to put you on the spot like that.
Absolutely.
Trump is a poor man's rich man.
Yes.
Would you give up your eyesight to keep your hands?
Yes.
The iPod was more revolutionary than drones have been or will be.
Yes.
One day, humans will not age past their prime.
Yes.
People should give up shaking hands forever.
No. That's pretty funny.
Okay, well, thanks for coming on, hey?
Cool, thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
Are you capturing this? I don't actually have Twitter. I know you were just going to tell people to follow me on Twitter, but I registered for a Twitter account, I think I was, would have been 2006 or something. It was quite a while ago. And I can't access, that was when I was in high school, and I no longer have access to my high school email address. So Twitter won't let me access my account. And
I'll just call up Jack Dorsey and get him to sort it out for you.
Yeah.